America is not some sort of government run by and for the people. It is essentially functioning as a world empire, and more importantly, is at least a seat of power through which trillions upon trillions of dollars of investment capital and finance are predicated. Why did these US military planners, who have known about this and planned for such an eventuality for so long, have gone guns blazing into Iran, knowing that would be the actual result? They wanted the closure of the strait and the destabilization of global energy markets.
A lot of people think this Iran war was a disaster, but in light of keeping US power in the oil markets, you're saying it actually could have been a success.
That is at least a thesis that I think has a lot of evidence to support it.
Hey everyone, this is Elijah K. Johnson with Gold Standard Economics. And with us today is James Corbett from the Corbett Report. James, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem, Elijah. Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you today. On this show, we want to take complex topics and really boil them down for the viewers and understand how they impact their everyday life and their everyday finances and economics. The topic I wanted to discuss today was false flags and wars, and how often they're economically motivated. So over the last few years, it seems like there's just been one war after another. And when we hear the mainstream narrative or the government's narrative of why we got into this in the first place, it seems a lot of the time to make absolutely no sense. And I know Eisenhower, you know, talked about the military-industrial complex and how a lot of the time war is just economically motivated. I guess you could pick any example. You know, we have Ukraine, Russia, you have Israel, Hamas, you have just what happened in Venezuela, you have the Iran conflict, which was seemingly just a disaster in the last 3 months. But did you want to, I guess, pick any one of those and kind of break the general topic down of what is really motivating all of these wars here?
It's an excellent question. So yes, let's look at some specific examples, and I'll choose a different one. How about the 2011 NATO campaign against Libya? Because people probably, hopefully, if they were around at the time, might remember that operation, but they probably don't remember the type of window dressing of an excuse for that operation that was given at the time, which was essentially, we have to bomb Libya back to the Stone Ages in order to liberate them from Muammar Gaddafi, who, of course, had been the leader of Libya for some time before that point, but suddenly became an issue there, right there at the beginning of 2011, for some reason, to the extent that it actually necessitated, according to Obama and the other world leaders at the time, the actual NATO intervention in that country that, of course, led to the complete dissolution of that government and descending Libya into chaos, including open-air slave markets and other such things. This was done, as I say, in the name of some sort of humanitarian intervention, but that obviously makes no sense. So it has to be looked at from other perspectives. And there are, of course, the geopolitical perspectives that you could look at the real motivations for a war like that. And there were, of course, geopolitical machinations going on. We know, for example, that the spectacular events at Benghazi had to do with the secret CIA annex that was operating there, that was being used to funnel arms towards Syria for the destabilization of that government. And that's what that operation was really about. But if we wanted to look at economic motivations for an intervention in Libya, there are several that we could look at. From the macroeconomic, for example, Gaddafi had been talking in the years before he was smart bombed off the planet, that he was talking about the creation of a gold dinar for Africa, the African nations, essentially, to unite behind, that would not be based on the US dollar, the petrodollar reserve as the world reserve currency. It would be its own attempt to back its own currency for a somewhat more economically sovereign African Union. That obviously is anathema to the various ruling powers, including, of course, those in Washington. But there is even very specific economic motivations that we could look into. Not only the fact that the very first thing that the rebels who were funded and aided in that NATO operation did after they seized control of Libya was to seize control specifically of the central bank and its gold reserves, but also we could look at the $50 million funding scandal that erupted in the wake of that intervention when it was discovered that French President Nicolas Sarkozy's entire presidential campaign had been funded by Gaddafi. And there were some, I think, loose ends that were being tied up in that operation, at least from the French perspective, to get rid of the evidence of that crime. Although it didn't work in Sarkozy's ultimate favor, that was uncovered. But that's an example of how obviously the excuse that was given on the surface level doesn't make any sense. And there are a plethora of reasons, geopolitical and economic, underlying them that give more of a detailed answer as to why that intervention happened. And I think that's a similar thing that we could apply to many of these conflicts that don't seem to make sense around the world.
Right. And I think the last time we talked actually was in 2018 when Trump was doing his first term. And one of the things that people pointed out as a great achievement of his first term was that there were no new major geopolitical conflicts during his first term, and people were hopeful for his second term that we wouldn't just have, you know, a neocon in the White House. We wouldn't have someone who would get us into more wars. But it seems like, and I guess the hope was that we were actually getting someone who would, okay, this time, you know, he's finally going to drain the swamp. You know, we're finally getting someone who's going to be in charge and kick the bad guys out. But it seems like nothing's changed. So what is your perspective on that? How it seems like this trend just continues regardless of who is in charge or who, I guess, you know, is the person that we're supposed to see as in charge?
Well, that's a very perceptive question because it gets to the heart of the issue. Although people may vote left or right for this boot or that boot, they end up getting the same boot on the face, essentially. And the question is why and how does this happen? So let's again look at a specific example like the recent military intervention in Iran. Why on earth would Trump 2.0 go to war in Iran after having essentially come to power in 2016 on the back of his campaign lambasting the Bushes of the world for their idiotic interventions in the Middle East and on the obvious debacle of Iraq? Why would he get himself embroiled in Iran? And again, I think there is a number of reasons for that. The most obvious of which has been now reported and is now known, is the series of lectures, essentially, that Trump received from Benjamin Netanyahu preceding this. Obviously, the toppling of the Iranian government has been on the top of Netanyahu's political wish list for decades now, and he has reportedly been trying to get every single American president in those decades to launch such an intervention. He was successful in the Trump case, and one can speculate as to why that is, what kind of political or other types of blackmail leverage that Netanyahu might have over the Trump administration. And obviously, for just crass geopolitical reasons in the Israeli case, it doesn't take a great deal of strategizing to understand why Israel would be interested in removing one of their great rivals in the region. But I think there are also geoeconomic and monetary reasons for the not only the intervention in Iran, but also in Venezuela and other such moves that we've seen taking place in the oil and energy markets, which together tended to, or at least in the short term, have tended to benefit the United States and its relative position in the global energy markets. Because as we know, of course, the U.S. is now a net energy exporter, but there is obviously a lot of oil that has been flowing through the Straits of Hormuz towards Asia, etc. That oil, to the extent that it's being denied to the Asian countries, the Asian countries will need it from somewhere. And of course, the U.S. is more than happy to supply it. Also, similarly, in Venezuela, of course, the point of the Venezuelan intervention may not have been simply to capture the oil reserves for the benefit of America per se, but at the very least to take those oil reserves away from China, who obviously did have an economic and geopolitical relationship with Venezuela up to the point of the spectacular regime change intervention in January. And since then, we have seen various cargo vessels, including Russian oil tankers, being stopped and boarded in international waters as part of what seems to be a thoroughgoing attempt to make sure that the United States is still the dominant energy supplier in the world and that the oil markets will continue to function in U.S. dollars. So there, I think there is geoeconomic reasons for, say, an intervention in Iran that did result in the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, exactly as U.S. military planners have known for decades. That is exactly the first thing that the Iranian regime would do in the event of an attack. And so it is absolutely no surprise that they did exactly that. The only question is, why did these U.S. military planners who have known about this and planned for such an eventuality for so long have gone guns blazing into Iran, knowing that would be the actual result? Well, the only logical conclusion is that they wanted that result. They wanted the closure of the strait and the destabilization of global energy markets, precisely because it affects China and other erstwhile threats to Washington's economic and geopolitical power.
It is so interesting because when we're talking about oil, for example, big talking point on the mainstream as well. You know, Trump wants to keep oil prices down because in the midterms, but it seems like you're looking at a much higher level of he's concerned about, or maybe the powers that be are concerned about U.S. hegemony and U.S. power in the oil markets. And actually, a lot of people think, you know, this Iran war was a disaster, but in light of keeping U.S. power in the oil markets, you're saying it actually could have been a success.
That is at least a thesis that I think has a lot of evidence to support it. And we could look at other examples of that in the past. For example, to the extent that the Iraq war, either Iraq War One or Two, was about oil, then it was not because Saddam Hussein was not allowing the oil to flow, or not enough oil was flowing, but precisely the opposite. Too much oil, too readily available, tends to drive down prices, which is ultimately not good for the multinational corporations and the oil conglomerates that tend to have inordinate amount of political significance, especially as they did in the Bush administration. So if we were to look at it from that perspective, then what was the result of the Venezuela debacle earlier this year? Was that an attempt to secure the Venezuelan oil for U.S. Purposes? That seems counterintuitive and not particularly productive, specifically because, of course, the Venezuelan oil is particularly heavy and requires more processing, facilities and requirements, which don't exist right now, and they have to be built up. And that would be predicated on having a stable government there that would be able to work with American financing to make such a thing happen to eventually benefit American oil companies. Maybe there is some long-term strategic plan there, but I think the more apt observation is that it was not about getting Venezuelan oil so much as preventing that oil from flowing to China. So I think we have to look at this more strategically. Yes, obviously, gas prices and domestic worries for U.S. Presidents have a part to play in the political calculus that gets made with these things. But there are broader geoeconomic interests for the broader American empire that I think supersede those colloquial domestic political interests.
Now, you mentioned the hegemony also of the U.S. dollar. How does that play in, and how has that played in recent wars? Because it seems like that has been waning throughout the years. And the petrodollar, for example, has seemingly weakened over time, or the dominance of the U.S. dollar. Does that play a huge role as well when it comes to getting in these various geopolitical conflicts?
I think there's no way to avoid that in any serious analysis of these geopolitical conflicts, precisely because, as you mentioned, the world reserve monetary financial system has been predicated on the U.S. dollar really since the end of World War II and after the Bretton Woods Conference and the formation of the Bretton Woods system to peg all currencies to the U.S. dollar, which itself was pegged to gold at $35 an ounce. We know, of course, that system never really totally properly functioned and ultimately completely fell apart in the late 1960s as America began its interventionism in Vietnam and started greatly inflating the monetary supply, worrying even America's allies or would-be allies like France, for example, which literally sent warships to New York Harbor to come collect their gold from the New York Federal Reserve, which was really the signaling of the end of that at least attempt at a Bretton Woods system. And as we know, in 1971, Nixon closed the gold window and gold convertibility. So the real question at that point is, well, then why is the U.S. dollar the world reserve currency and why should people be holding it? And that answer that was answered in short order by Nixon working for Rockefeller, of course, in the Kissinger working for Rockefeller in the Nixon administration, who managed to cobble together the petrodollar agreement with Saudi Arabia, in which U.S. oil would be denominated in U.S. dollars, and those U.S. dollars that Saudi Arabia received for its oil purchases would then be recycled back through the U.S. banking system and into U.S. treasuries, thus creating essentially the backing for the U.S. dollar predicated on the most precious commodity, the world's energy supply, oil. And that has been the backing, really the default backing of the world monetary financial paradigm for the last half century. And as you say, that is starting to show its age and starting to come apart. It was fake news reported that the petrodollar agreement between the US and Saudi Arabia had expired a couple of years ago. That was fake news. There was no single formal agreement. It was more of an under the table wink and nod agreement. That did have some aspects of certain things that were formalized, but those were not the linchpin of that that agreement. But having said that, Saudi Arabia has been inching out from under the U.S. umbrella in recent years and playing footsie with China and other would-be competitors to U.S. geoeconomic power. And as a result, we've seen the rise at least of the specter of a petro yuan. And although obviously the U.S. dollar is still the world reserve currency and by some far more margin, represents the settlement currency for most international settlement, it has been slowly eroding in recent years. And I think the writing is on the wall for this petrodollar system, unless, of course, some drastic, bold, empire-driven, military-backed sort of program was launched to ensure that energy hegemony going into the 21st century. And that's the way I would situate at least some of these moves that we're seeing taking place on the geopolitical chessboard at this point.
And on the topic of the U.S. dollar, one war that seems to have had a huge impact and has signaled to other countries that the U.S. dollar might not be safe is the Ukraine-Russia war. When that broke out with the U.S. sanctions and essentially the U.S. stealing, you know, $300 billion or around that much of Russian reserves, you know, it signaled to the world that the U.S. can just turn off other countries' accounts of U.S. dollars. That is kind of the mainstream view. It seems like a very foolish thing for the U.S. to do if the goal is to make the U.S. more powerful and the dollar more dominant. But do you think there's an error in that assessment? Do you think there's a higher level that we can see strategically what the U.S. did there? Or do you think it was just a foolish move, those sanctions on Russia?
As usual, there are several layers of analysis that you could apply to this or really any of these types of grand geopolitical situations. And as usual, there is always room for genuine incompetence when it comes to these types of events. But I tend to think, again, the strategists, for example, who knew that Iran was going to close the Strait of Hormuz in the event of an attack, are the same strategists who know the effects of not only, for example, the increasing sanctions pressure on Russia, which obviously will drive Russia closer into the arms of China and building up that axis of evil or whatever they're calling them at this point, but also moves like back in 2011 or was it 12 when Iran was originally delisted from SWIFT, which again, for people who don't know, of course, the bank, the interbank system through which international bank exchange takes place and settlements are affected between countries that takes place on the SWIFT network, which is a banking network that supposedly is completely politically independent, has nothing to do with politics. It's based in, I believe, Brussels, but at any rate, it doesn't have anything to do with international politics until 2012, when the U.S. Leaned on SWIFT to delist Iran as part of its sanctions regime against Rajam, against Iran. That was obviously a gigantic signal to everyone at the table that, of course, SWIFT is just another political means through which the U.S. specifically can wield its international geopolitical might. And as a result, the obvious response is for China and Russia and every other would-be monetary competitor to the United States to realize that they cannot rely on the SWIFT system in the event of future warfare, which is precisely why we saw, for example, the China interbank payment system being created in the middle part of the 2010s. And as I have noted many times before, and I will note here again, it is interesting to me that the CIPS, one of the very, very first things they did was sign a memorandum of understanding with SWIFT, for the SWIFT network to carry the majority of the CIPS transactions. So I think that, again, there's even another layer beyond the layers that we've already examined, a layer that has an interest in the formation of this, I would call it a phony type of conflict between, say, the US, NATO, Israeli, Anglo powers and the axis of resistance, broadly defined, Russia, China, Iran, etc. I think that there is, in fact, actually an even greater game at which there are economic and financial interests that are playing both sides simultaneously, and in which there are winks and nods and agreements between these two sides that are going on outside of public purview. And that's the way that I think this becomes even more complicated than before. But at any rate, I don't think it's simply a matter of miscalculation or oopsie, did we do that, when it comes to something like the sanctions regimes against Russia and its knock-on effects.
Sorry, can you expand on that a bit? It sounds like you were saying that there's another payment system being developed, or what was that you were speaking about there?
Yes, it's called the CIPS, the China Interbank Payment System, and it was developed specifically to be a type of SWIFT alternative, as in China and its friends around the world can interact and transact and settle without using the SWIFT network to transmit information. No, we will create this alternative network. It is called CIPS. Look it up and look up its history, but you will also be able to find the documentation of its memorandum of understanding with the SWIFT network, and the fact that the majority of payments on CIPS, I believe to this day, although I stand to be corrected on that, but at any rate, the last time I checked, the majority of payments traveling on the CIPS network were in fact being conducted by the SWIFT network. So it isn't actually an alternative at all, but it was presented to the public as such. And there are many examples of that phenomenon in different ways. For example, the New Development Bank, which was the BRICS nation's answer to the World Bank / IMF international financial infrastructure, which, as many people have pointed out over the years, is a type of debt trap in order to essentially affect a sort of financial neocolonialism on indebted countries to get them under the thumb of the Washington consensus in order to essentially sell off their infrastructure and resources at pennies on the dollar. And this is a debt trap structure that has been talked about for a long time. And many people have observed, well, we need a different system, a different paradigm that's going to be run by the good guys. And so we saw the development of the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, the AIIB, and the NDB, the New Development Bank, as these BRICS-run supposed alternatives to that structure. But as I have documented in the past, it turns out that many of the key executives and officials that have been at the tops of these organizations, the NDB and the AIIB, are the very self-same officials that were involved in the World Bank and the IMF. Once again, we find collusion going on behind the scenes. So I think there is an element in which we see the boogeyman of the 21st century, the China / Russia / Iran axis of resistance, is being built up in a way that is actually actively cooperating with the forces that they are supposedly operating against.
That is quite fascinating. It almost seems like a Republican-Democrat situation, you know, red or blue on a global scale. Is we're fed this narrative, and it seems, I mean, a lot of us are you know, hearing this narrative, and it makes a lot of sense that there's the BRICS nations and there's the Western nations, and then there's that competition. But what you're saying is it's not actually competition. They're all working together.
And that is my thesis, and I think it's backed up by a lot of documentation. And I think we can look at similar historical analogs to this type of situation when you start to examine the Cold War itself and the Soviets and how the Soviet economy was built up and maintained through active Western financial investment. You start to question some of the narratives that we've received about what the Cold War really was and who was really running it. And I think our incredulity at the idea that that there could be anything happening behind the scenes with regards to these types of structures or these obvious competitors only speaks to our lack of understanding of the system itself. And again, it's nice to believe if, for example, you're an American who considers yourself a good taxpaying citizen and it's our God-given right, we get to vote for the left party or the right party, and we are the government and we get to choose. It's a nice and comforting idea. But of course, it flies in the face of the fact that, of course, America is not some sort of government run by and for the people. It is essentially functioning as a world empire, and more importantly, is the at least a seat of power through which trillions upon trillions of dollars of investment capital and finance are predicated. Do we really suspect that the people who are wielding the massive influence of those trillions and trillions of dollars of investable capital are really going to leave the whims, the fate of their economic world to the whims of the American voter? I think that we can see that that is an incredibly implausible story. And it does, once again, start to make sense of some of the things that otherwise seem odd. Wait. People in 2008 were voting against Bush. They wanted those wars, the war of terror, to end. And the first thing, of course, that Obama did, once getting in after receiving his peace prize for doing exactly nothing, was not only to continue, but to expand those wars and the police state and the war on terror, and to take a suggestion that there would be prosecution for the war crimes of the Bush administration off the table. And then yet again, in 2016, once again, people were voting in Trump because he was talking about how absolutely stupid and ridiculous it is to be committing American resources to these expansionist wars of aggression in the Middle East. What's the point? We don't need any new wars. And of course, that is the same Trump who is now presiding over the Iran debacle and other foreign interventionism. It's almost as if the vote does not fundamentally matter, and there are forces above these political puppets who are directing this. And again, I think it makes sense when we see these not as nation states that are being run by and for the people, but essentially as gangster organizations that are in charge of, as I say, trillions and trillions of dollars of capital. I think we know who really calls the shots in these set types of scenarios, and it isn't the politician sitting in the supposed seat of power.
And that gets back to the central thesis that it's about the economics of the matter. It's about finances. So often you see that's the real reason for all of these conflicts. So getting that definitely is, I think, important. I guess if you can expand on why is that important for our viewers, if we're hearing, you know, this is happening in whatever country, just instead of buying into the mainstream narrative, why should viewers be a bit more critical? How does that benefit them?
It's an excellent question, because I understand that this perspective that I'm painting here can be incredibly dispiriting to people who hear this information and then think, well, okay, so it doesn't matter and my vote doesn't matter and this is all taking place in levels far above where I am, so what can I do? Oh, well, I'll just go back to my life and try to get by the best I can. That is the opposite of the message I'm trying to convey. But I think in order to truly understand the problem and thus to really come up with solutions to that problem, we have to actually look at the problem squarely and correctly diagnose that problem. And if we're not doing that, then we're going to be led into the very types of false solutions that have hitherto been presented to us, like, say, vote for politician X or politician Y. Don't worry, he will come along and save the day. Once we get out of that false solution paradigm, we can start actually looking at things that we can actually do to affect what is happening at this much grander level. And of course, it always comes back to what we individually do with the resources and the abilities that we have within our control. That is the first and foremost thing that we need to keep in mind. So, very first and foremost, for example, in my line of work, I have often been asked over the years, okay, well, I understand about all these conspiracy theories that you're painting there, but how do I profit from this? How do I make money from it? What should be my investment strategy with regards to this? And I've always said, well, if your only concern is making dollars in this bought and controlled system, then you could simply invest in the military-industrial complex. And I guarantee, at least as long as things continue in the vein that they have been continuing for decades now, if not centuries, you will make a tidy profit on that investment. You will get a return. But the real question is that what you want? Do you want to, for example, build up the military-industrial complex that is waging such havoc around the world in order to help fund your retirement? Perhaps we have to start taking a more strategic look at the way that our finances are helping to fuel this machine and how they could be helping to fuel others who are trying to make a difference in the world rather than the military-industrial complex. Of course, that might not be as profitable an investment, certainly while the world is still being run by these multi-trillion dollar multinational corporations and entities that have a vested and sometimes direct interest in warfare. But at any rate, it seems it would be easier to sleep at night if we started to realize our own responsibility when it comes to things along this nature. And then we can start thinking and talking about how we can build up a Main Street economy that actually matters again, rather than the Wall Street phony baloney economy that has been sold to us over the past several decades.
I think that's so important, again, to focus on, well, what do we have charge over? We have charge over our own lives and our own local economies. And often it seems like, Israel, for example, is a great example where it seems like people on either side are just going absolutely crazy. And you look at it and you're like, this can't be good for society. Like, what is happening? The division that we're seeing. But obviously that can be the goal of the people on the, the elite, to kind of keep people distracted, right? Instead of looking at the real issues, taking constructive action to bring back power to the people. So what are some of those ways that, I guess, on an economic level, people can stop feeding the military-industrial complex, but instead start feeding their local communities?
It's an excellent question. And in fact, I'm just as we are recording this, I'm about to tackle that very question in an upcoming edition of my Solutions Watch podcast, where I look at various ideas for implementing solutions, given the state of the affairs that we find ourselves in. And one of those is the question of how do we start connecting with local businesses and local businessmen and women that we can transact with, perhaps even in ways that aren't that don't revolve around the monetary paradigm that we've been given. For example, is it possible to transact in various other ways, barter or local exchange trading systems or cryptocurrency or precious metals or other ways that aren't beholden to the US dollar empire? And again, that's the type of thing that's obviously not going to be possible if we're buying everything from Amazon or Walmart, but it might be possible if you're transacting with actual local businesses consisting of local businessmen and women. And I've looked at, in recent editions of Solutions Watch, I was looking, for example, at an upstart in my home and native land of Canada, specifically in my home of Alberta, specifically with regards to the question of John Deere, who has come under fire in recent years, not only for their woke DEI policies that various workers and customers have been fretting about, but also because of their vehement resistance to the right to repair movement. They are selling these very, very expensive tractors that tend to break down and cannot be repaired by the farmer himself or a local repairman. No, it has to be sent back to the dealer, and sometimes it could take weeks at the height of harvest to fix this tractor. It seems like an intractable problem, but I highlighted this other company called Ursa Ag that is building tractors that will work, at least for small farmers, that do not require these elaborate computer systems that you don't have access to in order to fix a tractor. No, it's just a simple mechanical tractor that works. And that's the type of, again, I'm not vouching for Ursa Ag. I'm certainly not a customer of them, and I'm not promoting them. I'm just saying those are the types of ideas that are possible when we start asking, how can we use our own resources to create things for our own communities and our own like-minded, hopefully freedom-oriented people around the world who are interested in supporting endeavors like these? Can we get around this idea that we need to go cap in hand to the multinational corporations that can then dictate whatever terms they want to us in order for us to be allowed to access their infrastructure? Or can we start providing it for ourselves? And if the answer to that last question, can we start providing it to ourselves, is no, then I suppose all hope is lost. But I don't believe that. I believe that if we start consciously directing our attention and our resources to this very, very large problem, well, at the very least, if we don't start doing that, I know we will lose. So I know that there really is no alternative. We have to start building up an alternative economy.
And it does seem like a lot of people are doing that. I was actually visiting a friend and we're wanting to maybe get out of the farther away from a big city. And I was visiting a friend in a very small city up in the north, kind of northwestern U.S. And I was like, so where do you grocery shop? You know, there, I guess there's a kind of limited grocery options up here. And he's like, well, I kind of don't. I go to the farmer's market, I buy a whole cow, I get raw milk and all that. It's like, fantastic. Like, this is great. You're working with your local community. And I think more and more people are doing that.
I think that is the way forward. I'm not saying that this is going to be an easy thing to accomplish, and it's certainly not going to happen overnight. But I think the baby steps towards that goal are important to be taking yesterday, preferably. But if not, then today is a good day to start. And it will take time and it will be a difficult process. But if we don't engage in that process, then we are going to be beholden to these gigantic financial interests that are taking a greater and greater share of the world's resources. Unfortunately, it's up to each of us to do what we can within our own sphere of ability.
Certainly. And I guess one thing is probably not get too caught up on the mainstream narrative of all these conflicts and everything. Maybe turn the TV off once in a while would be a good idea. But if our viewers are interested in finding you, where can they go?
The best place to go is CorbettReport.com. It's C-O-R-B-E-T-T report.com. I've been doing that work for nearly 20 years now. We're coming up on 20 years quite soon that I've been doing this work. There's literally thousands of hours of audio, video material, textual material there that is available completely for free as a resource. I hope people will use it as the resource as it is. And if people are interested, of course, they can support the work and make sure it's possible in the future by becoming a member of the website. But I would not encourage them to do so unless and until they've done a dive into my work and understand what it is I'm doing.
Fantastic. Any last thoughts before we let you go, James?
I think this is an incredibly important subject, and I'm glad you brought it up. I think it's a vastly neglected sphere of research, specifically the economic reasons for various false flag events and or wars and or conflicts is often neglected. But if the old adage that you need to follow the money if you're going to find the perpetrators of an event are true, then surely that is true in when we're investigating these gigantic conflicts and or spectacular terror attacks that tend to take place and that we're given inadequate explanations for. And I've attempted to do that with a documentary I did on 9/11 Trillions, Follow the Money, which explored the various money trail aspects of 9/11. I think, again, there's still a wealth of information there left to be explored by, I hope, future researchers who will pick up that mantle and run with it. But with regards to that, I would say that any one of the events we've talked about today and or any of the other major events that we've been looking at, a very interesting way to look at them would be through the economic lens. So thank you for bringing up this idea, and I hope other people will start thinking along these lines and contributing to this research.
Fantastic. James, once again, thank you so much for your time today, and God bless.
You're welcome.